Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and in the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Carrie Hilson, Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school like, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Inside the Studio on iHeartRadio. My name's Jordan Runtog, but enough about me. My guest today heralded his artistic arrival with his 1998 self-titled debut, a gloriously maximalist affair that marked him as both wildly talented and wildly unclassifiable. His musical maturity and dramatic flair set him apart, and since then, he's defied expectations with a series of unpredictable but always intriguing projects, not to mention always rewarding. When he titled his last album Unfollow the Rules, it seemed less like a name than a mission statement. He's one of my musical heroes, and now he's paying tribute to a musical hero of his own. He famously restaged Judy Garland's iconic Carnegie Hall show in 2006, complete with a full band and a full audience. Now, in honor of what would have been her 100th birthday, he's releasing a more stripped-down affair. Backed by a jazz quartet, he recorded the tracks in Hollywood's historic Capitol Records studios. For an added dose of authenticity, he even employed a microphone she'd once used. The scaled-down arrangements are mirrored by the scaled-down audience. In this case, it was just one person. His friend Renee Zellweger, who portrayed Garland in the 2019 film Judy. My guest today has done an equally stunning job inhabiting the larger-than-life talent on this new record. Rufus Does Judy at Capitol Studios. I'm so happy to welcome Rufus Wainwright. Judy, one of my favorite topics. I know one of yours as well. You've talked about really first embracing the Judy's Carnegie Hall album as a way of providing joy for yourself in the aftermath of 9/11. Giving the last 2 years we've all had, I feel like we could all use a dose of that Judy Rufus magic right now. So I feel like the timing is perfect.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't actually 9/11. It was the invasion of Iraq, which was after. I mean, because right after 9/11, there was this moment, brief moment, when it seemed like the world was going to come together and be, you know, supportive of the United States and try to heal from that, you know, tragedy. But then all next thing you know, we were invading Iraq. And it was just such a kind of non sequitur and really traumatic experience that I still believe we you know, suffer the consequences of. So yes, at that point, the Judy record became a reminder of sort of a slim reminder of just the occasions where, you know, the U.S. can be a fabulous place and create, you know, love and brilliance and positivity. And yes, I think definitely today, in this day and age, especially even maybe even more than back then, at least domestically, we are in a, you know, a pretty sad predicament, and we have to once again, you know, try to resurrect what makes this place a great place, the United States.
I mean, just the spirit of this music, I feel like it's so, so necessary and needed right now. And obviously, your relationship with Judy transcends the Carnegie Hall album. You have a very deep relationship with the song Over the Rainbow, which you've been singing since you were a child. How did you first get in touch with Judy?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because there's a classic story at this point in my life where when I first met Lorna Luft, Judy's daughter, I was, and this is all on film, I believe, somewhere. I should find the footage. Anyways, but one of the first things I said to her was, you know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow is my song. I just sort of brazenly, expressed that because, you know, I sang it since I was a little kid and, you know, just totally missing the point that, you know, it was actually written for her mother. So yes, I've always had a very intense relationship to that piece of music, but mainly because my mother taught it to me when I was very young, and she used, and I guess my, you know, rendition was so captivating that it became a kind of weapon that she could use, you know, at parties and, you know, to either, you know, get people's attention or to, you know, let's say end an evening, you know, where things had gotten a little too sloppy. So, you know, bring down the kid and have him sing Somewhere the Rainbow and then I can go to bed kind of thing. So it was, it had a whole range of usages.
And I love your rendition on this new live album. The a cappella opening was just chills.
Yeah, that's very much an homage to my mother. Yeah. Sadly, Kate McGarrigle, who sadly passed away over 10 years ago. So me singing, because on the original Carnegie Hall album, she's accompanying me solo on the piano and then, you know, the orchestra comes in. So it's a nod to that.
Oh, it's so beautiful. I mean, there's so many incredible moments on this record. I mean, I wanted to ask you, to me, Judy Garland is just one of the most compelling figures in entertainment. I mean, her talent, her strength, her stories. I love her movies and her albums. I love the autobiography tapes she made where you just hear her fire. I just think it's so, so captivating. What is it about Judy that captivates you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it started early, with The Wizard of Oz and all of that. But I will say that, you know, there's a funny little family connection as well, because, you know, my dad, Loudon Wainwright III, he was actually briefly, or for a couple of years, brought up in Beverly Hills, because his father, my grandfather Loudon Jr., was covering Hollywood for Life magazine, and they were friends with Judy, and in fact Judy Garland, I think, babysat my dad once or something, and him and Liza used to hang out as when they were around 10 years old. So there is actually a personal connection. And I'm now, you know, quite good friends with Lorna as well. So it's been, you know, a couple of generations here, or three, arguably. But yes, in terms of her music and her star status and the power of her legacy, yeah, no, that hit me young. And then all through my life, you know, whether it was, you know, my trials and tribulations with addiction, or my, you know, desire to be like the best singer possible, or my, you know, just wanting to have a laugh, you know, Judy Garland was always there as a beacon of sorts.
Oh, that's what has always fascinated me about her. I mean, this hope and these bluebirds and rainbows in the face of these tremendous, you know, personal demons and just that strength that she always displayed. You mentioned the story with your father. I love your song Me and Liza. I think is a tribute to that. It's a great track.
Definitely.
So this album, you recorded the album at Capitol, and you used the mic she used, which that must have been just so special. I'm a huge believer in places and artifacts being imbued with that energy. What was that like?
Well, you know, on one hand, it was incredible. But I also feel like, on the other hand, it's quite common, in the sense that, you know, I've worked in amazing studios for years in Hollywood and Los Angeles, sorry, all over the city. And, you know, a really amazing mic is often used, you know, so because they don't make them like they used to. And there is something very organic about that whole, world. And so I'm pretty sure that I've used a lot of mics that have been used by a lot of great people. But yes, pointing that out and really focusing on that for this recording was a wonderful experience. And I think especially doing it in the room, you know, where she recorded herself, you know, gave it an extra kind of, you know, sparkle. But it's one of the perks of living in LA. You know, there are problems with this town, but there are upsides too.
I mean, that room and that microphone. I was at a concert of yours once, and you described yourself as the secret child of Judy Garland and Frank Sinatra. So I feel like being in that room is perfect, right?
Yes,
there.
Yes. I was born in that room. I came out of an amplifier,
an old tube amplifier. Yeah, classic. Did you own any artifacts of Judy's?
Do I own any artifacts of Judy's? You know, I don't. I do have a signed copy of her, you know, Carnegie Hall record that she signed. I don't, the one that I was very close to Carrie Fisher. So I have some, you know, some of her stuff, but some stuff of her mother's, but nothing of Judy's yet. What I'd love to get is a compact. I'm a collector of compacts. I have quite a few compacts of famous opera singers, like, you know, Regine Caspian, Victoria de Los Angeles. So, you know, for makeup and stuff. So maybe I'll ask Lorna if she could, you know, one day contemplate that as a gift of sorts, or I'll pay, you know, for something.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I love. I watched the virtual concert when this was recorded, and I love that your micro audience consists of Renee Zellweger, who obviously is a dear friend of yours, and brilliantly portrayed Judy. And I was wondering, when she was in the midst of making that film, did you both talk about, you know, about kind of getting inside Judy at all?
Well, I mean, we had a couple of interactions, but she'd already really made the film at that point. You know, this was when she was working on the album from the movie. Yes, we had a couple of conversations of sort of but it was mostly about the aftermath of having, you know, inhabited her spirit. And and it was really wonderful. But in terms of like when you know, when she began that process, you know, I think she's a professional. She knows what she's doing. Doesn't need my help.
I think referring to the original concert you did in 06, you described it as an exorcism of sorts. I thought that was a really interesting choice of words. I wanted to ask you more about that.
Yeah, no, it was very much a kind of celebration, but yes, an exorcism as well. I had sort of moved to Hollywood to make my first album and brought along my, you know, Judy obsession as well. And I kind of went on and on and on. And then at a certain point when I decided to do the Carnegie Hall concert, I think I was just ready for another stage in my life where I could sort of, focus on other kind of legacies, shall we say. I did actually after that series of concerts feel less kind of, you know, inclined to buy a Judy Garland record whenever I would go to a record store, which I used to do all the time. And what's also interesting is that when I did the 10th anniversary concerts at both Carnegie Hall and also in Toronto with an orchestra, the minute I started them, I instantly felt nothing like Judy Garland. I really did feel much more like my dad, Frank Sinatra. And, you know, had more of a masculine kind of approach, kind of more a tougher delivery, shall we say. But what's nice is that now with this recording that I did it, that we did at Capitol Studios and so forth, I feel like she's returned. You know, I feel like there's sort of I'm maybe more channeling her studio work and her kind of, how can I say it, her kind of almost medical or fine, you know, attention paid to the songs. You know, there's the clinical
precision
precision that she had with singing that's captured in her studio work. So she's back.
Oh, that's one of the things that I think is so amazing about these arrangements that are more stripped down. It doesn't have the 36 piece orchestra, but a small jazz combos. I feel like there's more room for the emotion to shine through, and we can hear kind of every breath of and pause of yours more. And I think that makes it adds a level of, I don't know what the right word is. Darkness is certainly not the word I want to use, but there's, you can
depth.
Yeah.
Depth, I think it's a combination of things. It's both doing it in the studio, but also the fact that I've now been singing these songs for almost 20 years. So they are, you know, very much encrusted in my bones and stuff. And, which Judy had when she did her Carnegie Hall show. That was always something that, that I feel like I was, you know, I could never, you know, match. But now that I feel I can maybe match her on certain numbers, not all of them by any means, but on certain ones, those songs I have made my own, some of them.
Is it in a sense because you've lived some of them in a way? Suddenly those experiences are more personal to you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're also, you know, there are love songs and there are also songs about survival and songs about, sentimental thoughts and so yes, I think as you get older, you start to, you know, things become more precious and more valuable and more fleeting and so therefore a little bit more, you know, sad. So the songs, I can sort of imbue the songs with that.
And that's the thing that always blows me away is that I've reached to put on your live album and or an horror original live one as well over the years. And, you know, I'll put it on when I want to, you know, hear when I feel a little nostalgic and I want to hear, you know, almost like Being in Love or something and feel a little up, and I'll put it on. And I'm always blown away by the power of it and just the struck by the power. It's that just the depth of it is, it's so, you know, you expect some, you know, some levity, but I'm always, it always becomes a something that you can't put on in the background. Let me put it that way. Something that demands your attention.
Yes. Well, that's interesting you bring that up, because I think on one hand, that has been my greatest asset and also my greatest detraction.
Why is that?
Well, in the sense, I mean, like the music that I've created, whether it's my Judy Garland work or my other albums for that matter, you know, yes, you cannot put them in the background, and they demand a certain amount of attention, and that works great. You know, if you're into music and you want to kind of go on that journey, but if you just want to sit around and have a cup of coffee or watch a commercial and focus on, you know, the car, then my music it can be problematic because it does demand everyone's attention. So it's something that I've always tried to juggle, you know, and let's just say that we don't live in necessarily the most, kind of thoughtful period of time. So it's a struggle. But on the other hand, I think for those who do appreciate that and who are willing to, go on the journey with me, you know, they become very loyal and they keep coming back. So that's how it works for me.
I feel like I owe you a huge thanks as a music fan. I was always aware of this concert and its place in pop culture history, but it really wasn't until your rendition in 2006 and the album came out in the following year that I delved into this catalog and absorbed these songs. And I was wondering how much of that was a motivating factor for you to kind of pass these songs along to people that, you know, might not know them.
You know, that's a whole subject on its own. The fact that period in American songwriting is arguably the, you know, kind of the golden era of American music. Whether it's, you know, the arrangements or the lyrics or the melodies, you know, it seemed like everything was working at full speed at that time. I very much consider it kind of a legacy that as an American, and I'm both, I'm Canadian and American, but as, on my American side, you know, I it's important to celebrate and try to match, you know, whether it's with your singing or your songwriting, so that we can continue this excellence and so forth.
Do you feel in any way that you've come to understand Judy any better, having gotten inside her for these songs and these performances?
I do feel that there's through the performances and the songs, I mean, I am constantly, and this hasn't really changed over the years, you know, amazed by her technical ability in the sense, not so much in her singing. I mean, she's an incredible singer and she cuts the corners and that's fantastic. But just in her whole presentation, you know, how she really knew how to move on stage. You know, how she where her gaze was focused. She was an incredible dancer. You know, and so just that whole kind of training thing, which in our day and age is so lacking, you know, in terms of the entertainers today. Though some can do it, you know, when you know Justin Bieber or, you know, Lady Gaga, you know, they work really hard on the full package. So it's not dead or anything. But hers is so effortless and so kind of, I don't know, elegant. So there's that, but in terms of actually talking to people who knew her, and worked with her, I am always fascinated by how I think her personality was very different from that which the public expected. You know, it was, I think she was a lot sort of dirtier in the sense, like she was kind of, she had a real kind of, how can I say this, wicked streak in her that was hilarious, but also pretty, scary if you were, you know, in the line of fire. And there was this kind of, you know, punk rock thing about her that is always, you know, I don't know, pretty fascinating, and makes me, of course, appreciate her more.
Oh yeah,
man. She was not a good girl.
I mean, watch those interviews with her. I think it's Steve Allen that she's on. She gives these great interviews, but she tells these stories, and she's rowdy on network TV in the early 60s. It's incredible.
Yeah, she is. And I think that that's just the tip of the iceberg, frankly.
Oh, so interesting. So multifaceted. And I do want to say, as somebody who's seen you perform a number of times for 20 years, oh my God. Yeah, 20 years. I truly believe, as a fan, you possess that effortlessness. I don't know how you do what you do. You have this ability to. I saw you at Lupo's Heartbreak Hotel in Rhode Island in 2003, I believe, and it felt like you were singing. I remember I was there with a dear friend of mine, and we were driving home after. You said, "Oh my God, it felt like he was singing to us." And I feel like that's something that Judy and all the greats have, where you just connect with everybody in the audience. And I
thank you.
Thank you. This Judy concert was the finale of your, I have to pause, Rufus Retro Wainwright-spective. There we go. It was the finale of your Rufus Retro Wainwright-spective, where you revisited all your past albums. We actually spoke soon after you started doing these shows in early 2020 for your debut in Poses. I wanted to ask you, what is your relationship like to these earlier songs now? Do you recognize that person who wrote them and recorded them? Or is it like looking at an old school photo?
No, I mean, I know they're all very, I do recognize that person. I mean, I tend to subscribe to a more kind of Hindu type explanation of existence. I'm not Hindu, but there's, they, for instance, and I'm really, you know, butchering this whole concept. But, you know, essentially they believe that, you know, a person is made up of six or seven people. And and that, you know, and I felt over the years that they're very much like a tree. You know, I developed these branches of my personality. And at this point, you know, I'm kind of high up and I can look down and really, you know, still feel and see, you know, these other characters that I've inhabited and created and that are still, you know, within me. So I think the minute you start to say, oh, I'm no longer that person, that's, you know, the beginning of the end. That's when that person decides to, you know, hijack the situation. So yes, I'm very respectful of my past incarnations.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line.
oh, that's not this, oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Check the back seat. Check the back seat.
All right, come here.
Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
You recently released a incredibly fascinating, I guess we'll call it an audio memoir on Audible called Road Trip Elegies, Montreal to New York. One of the most powerful moments for me was a conversation you had with your aunt, Anna, where she told you, I'm paraphrasing, to embrace your family's fantastic legacy, which to me, it was just like the opening of an Arthurian legend.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just so, I've seen those amazing clips of you performing, you know, HMS Pinafore at school as a teen. Was music something that was always something of sort of like a given for you, or was there a turning point?
No, music was always front and center. And that's really mostly due to my mother, Kate, who, you know, now that she's passed, I really can, you know, I can quantify the loss. Because, you know, she was someone who always needed to play the piano, always needed to, you know, teach a song to someone, always needed to hear what someone's voices was like if they were visiting. You know, like music was just always streaming through her veins. And now that she's gone, the world is very different. You know, I love to sing. My sister loves to sing. My aunt Anna loves to sing. But we're not necessarily, you know, doing it every night, which when my mother was alive, you know, that was the case. We still perform a lot, and music is still very central. But Kate was really the engine.
I loved your song for her, Beauty Mark. That's one of my favorites of yours.
Thank
such
you.
Such a great smirk of a tribute. I love it so much. I mean, I'm hard pressed to think of an artist who right out of the gate had developed such a singular voice and style that was all your own. I mean, it just seemed like you arrived completely, fully formed in 1998. What was inspiring you when you first went into the studio to record your debut?
Well, I mean, I think I was brought up, and both by my mother and father, actually, and family members, to really appreciate excellence in all sorts of songwriting, you know, whether it was standards or classical music or folk music. I mean, there was a real wide variety of material that I grew up with and appreciated. And so I just felt like whatever I was going to do, it had to match that code, you know, and it had to be something that was really attempting to you know, I don't know, just last. So I just had that drilled into me as a young person, and when I went in to make my records, you know, that was my main objective. I mean, it wasn't necessarily about, you know, what the kids were doing at that time or who I was hanging out with or what was going on in the mainstream. It was just about like, let's try and create something that's as good as what I grew up, what I've heard so far, and what I've learned to appreciate. And it was this kind of tunnel vision that once again was a help and a hindrance, because, you know, I was certainly recognized, but it wasn't by any means what was going on musically at that time. So it was an interesting journey.
Here's a loaded question that I didn't write down, but it's just popping in my head now. Do you consider yourself a romantic?
Well, I always find the word romantic so interesting because, you know, it comes from Rome. You know, I guess it's sort of about, you know, it pertains to, you know, like these kind of Germans and, you know, 19th century figures who started to, you know, become these neoclassic type of worshipers and other things. But Rome itself was very, very kind of unforgiving and, you know, unemotional and kind of stoic, you know, as a culture. So I think in a strange way, when I think of romantic, I think of two sides. I think, yes, you know, yeah, I am emotional. I am, you know, I am driven by my heart's desires. I am, you know, swept away, but I'm also very disciplined and very, very kind of, pragmatic and, you know, dictatorial when I need to be. So yes, I think in the full sense of the word, thinking both of 19th century romanticism and also Rome, the Roman culture, I can kind of inhabit both.
What is your process like when you are writing? Do you have a feeling that you want to express and go to a piano and kind of play it out of you? Or do you hear music in your mind and it's just a case of getting it down?
Both. I mean, it's both. I set, you know, kind of little traps for myself, you know, whether it's, you know, having to write a song for musicals or, you know, for an album coming up. But then coupled with that, I will be pretty awake and kind of willing to receive messages from wherever, you know, and there's often like turns of phrases or little melodies that kind of strike me and that I know immediately that I've caught something by the tail and that I got to go home and, you know, reel it in. So it's kind of a combination of both of you know, being, you know, very organized about it and also being completely receptive and willing to, you know, go with the flow.
Is there an element of superstition involved at all?
Oh yeah, no, totally. For me, I mean, I do. You know, I have tarot cards. I visit, you know, grave sites. You know, I do. I have pilgrimages. I respect, you know, birthdays of famous songwriters and stuff. So yeah, no, it's all whatever powers I can muster. I call in.
I love that so much. That was something I loved about Road Trip Elegies, where you kind of talked about the relationship between geography and creativity and songwriting. And I thought that was so cool, how a place can influence you, you know, so deeply. And you live in Laurel Canyon now. That must be very inspiring.
No, it is incredibly inspiring. And I'm actually working on an album now that I'm finishing up, which is really more folk-based. And yeah, no, I've been singing some of those, you know, classic Laurel Canyon numbers and very, very much, trying to bring back this kind of 60s, optimism that we are sadly, you know, not inhabiting at the moment.
Oh, I've been loving some of your covers of I Saw Harvest recently and your version of Who Knows Where the Time Goes with Brandi Carlile. Is amazing. So I love your covers of that era. There was an interview you gave recently. I thought this was so interesting, where you were talking about the song Poses, and which is something that I had always assumed was autobiographical. And you're talking about how you wrote it about an acquaintance or a friend. And it wasn't until years later that you realized you were sort of describing what was happening to you. And I wanted to ask, do you often find yourself learning things about yourself from your own songs?
Yes. I mean, I will say that, you know, for anybody who wants to know the truth about me and who wants to sort of dive into the deep end of my, you know, existence, it's all in my songs. I mean, it's everything that I write is very much, bound to a personal either a personal experience or a personal view or a personal, you know, trauma, whatever. And it's kind of and I have found over the years, now that I start to look back at songs that I wrote when I was a lot younger, that in fact I was being very honest and very kind of I was burying myself in this material, and that is the true kind of testament of who I am and what I believe in. So it's all in there, and that is you know, I've made that that bargain, you know. So, yeah, definitely.
And your songs are so personal, which is, I think, why so many people connect with them. At what point do you start thinking about the audience when you're writing? Or do you not? Is that limiting to you?
Well, I like to think, the only thing that I like to think about is that if the song is to be interpreted by somebody else, or if it's, you know, to be approached in a way that the performer doesn't have any kind of connection to me or know anything about the backstory, that it does make sense, you know, that it has its own kind of architecture. So I am cognizant of that. And I also think a lot about, am I, you know, ripping off someone else, or is this too similar to something I've written before? You know, does it stand on its own? So I am very cognizant and careful about that kind of stuff.
I feel that a lot of creative people find it hard to make a differentiation between their lives and their work, and which for good reason, because it's such a reflection of yourself and who you are, and it comes from such a personal place and whatever you're going through. Are there times when you feel like that, when you feel like it's tough to distinguish between those two, draw a line?
I think there are, but it's mostly in life. I mean, in the sense that, you know, I work all the time and I'm writing all the time, and I kind of live in this kind of cloud, like I live in this cloud like existence. But then when there are, you know, daily or maybe more weekly, shall we say, events that occur where, you know, you got to do the homework with your kid, or you have to clean up the house, or you have to go to the doctor, you know, whatever, you know, I am kind of woken up and a bit brutally and taken out of this dream that I'm mostly inhabit. So it's but you know, it's I'm a very fortunate man. I have incredible family and friends, and I've done well in my career, so I can afford, you know, to live a certain way. So it's all good. But yes, it can be a bit of a rude awakening when you have to, you know, do homework with your 11-year-old, and you're like, oh my God, I might not know this.
Oh, no. Oh, Viva's got to have the best taste in music of any 11-year-old. Oh my goodness.
No, she has very good taste in music. She does, actually. Yeah. Oh, no, she loves Dolly Parton. She loves the Eurythmics. Yeah, no, she has a good, and she also knows all the popular stuff that the kids listen to. So she's very very curious kid in that sense.
Has she taught you any new music names yet, or is that kind of a few years down the road?
She's tried to, but I'm a bad student in that sense of what's popular. I've always been, you know, it takes me several years to realize why something is a hit, which is, you know, sort of not the point of the whole exercise.
It's funny. I mean, the last 2 years, I feel like, you know, it's been so uncertain and stressful. I've been finding myself revisiting music I haven't listened to in decades, stuff I listened to in high school, just as kind of musical comfort food. Have you been doing that? Kind of like we were talking about with Judy.
I mean, I think there's some interesting stuff. I mean, I do like Lil Nas X. I actually like The Weeknd. And I do, you know, it's not all terrible. But that being said, I don't feel that there's necessarily a kind of, we're in a high point in terms of songwriting. I you know, it seems more about, you know, the package that's being offered and sort of the dream that's being attacked or that they're attacking with. And so it's not about the actual songs themselves, but that's my territory. That's where I'm sort of, you know, staking my claim.
Last summer, on the heels of your absolutely phenomenal and Grammy nominated, I might add, album Unfollow the Rules, you released the track with Amber Sounds called Technopra, which was a whole new sound for you. It was so cool. Rufus Does EDM. Where did that come from? Is that something that you want to explore further? It's so interesting.
Well, that was a bit of a pandemic pastime, because you know, I worked with Zen Freeman on that, and he lives down the street. So I think it was one of these things where, you know, because there wasn't touring going on, and we were, you know, homebound, that it was a good idea to just check out who lived in the neighborhood and who we could just hang out with, you know, safely and make music with. So I think that really stemmed from that whole situation.
I mean, there have been so many incredible home concerts that you've shared with fans over the last 2 years while we're all kind of homebound, and obviously you're keeping busy with music. Are there any other sort of new hobbies that you've discovered in the last 2 years?
Well, drawing. I've been doing a lot of illustrating.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. No, I went to art school briefly in Montreal when I was, you know, a teen in my 20s, and so yeah, I've taken that back up, and it seems to have stuck. I now draw regularly, and we used some of the artwork in the last album, but you will be seeing more of it in the future as well.
Oh, that's so exciting. Oh my goodness. Do you have any, how far, I know it's probably too early to say, but how far along is this new album?
It's almost, we're mixing it right now.
Oh, wow. Oh,
this folk record. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to even announce anything, but it will be, I think it's going to come out around my birthday, which is in about a year. So there's still time, but it's, or in honor of my birthday, I'll be 50 next year. So around my 50th birthday, we're gonna have a picking session. Do some picking.
Oh my goodness, Rufus, I could talk to you all day. My last question before I let you go, and it's a corny one, but I'm genuinely curious. If you could have a moment with Judy and you could say one thing to her, what would it be?
I think I would just say thank you for inspiring me for so long, and also for being this, you know, endless source of fascination, both fascinating and inspiring. So yeah, just a big thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Inside the Studio, a production of iHeartRadio. For more episodes of Inside the Studio or other fantastic shows, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing.
This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you, from Carrie Hilson, Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school, like,
yeah.
Okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.